You're listening to the Transnational Black Feminisms Podcast, co-hosted by Tammy Navarro and Premila Nadison at the Center for the Study of Social Difference at Columbia University and Barnard College.
Hi, this is Tammy Navarro. I'm co-director of the Transnational Black Feminisms Working Group, and I'm here with Natasha Lightfoot, professor of history at Columbia University.
Hello.
Hey, Natasha, how are you?
I'm good. I'm honored to be speaking with you today.
Oh, me too. So Natasha, we're both members of the Transnational Black Feminisms Working Group. Can you tell me a little bit about how you feel your work relates to those themes?
I guess I could start by saying that my work is focused on the transition from slavery to freedom in the Anglophone Caribbean, and some of the questions I ask are about sort of what everyday freedom means, how people's transition looks very different and oftentimes runs in direct opposition to how British colonial administrators envisioned freedom to be, a sort of ongoing, tidy segue from slavery, in that everyone was supposed to be free in name only. And so much of the work that I chart in what became my first book is about, these everyday oppositions that become the stuff of what free life is, and how these struggles unfold sometimes, not just against the British, but also within free black communities in the island of Antigua, which is where my family is from and what drew me to the subject matter, and also its sister island, Barbuda, at points. And so much of what I chart is about what unfolds between families within community, related to questions around what about the transition from slavery to freedom is also a very gendered set of considerations that will affect women and men equally oppressively, but in different ways. In particular, the questions surrounding what is the meaning of, sort of household labor, gendered kinds of self-presentation, ideas about Black women's bodies and what is supposed to be a productive laboring body in public spaces, the kinds of resistances that are put forth by this free community as it's trying to become free in public, and how those look different among women versus men, how men and women fight in the street against other men and women. It's all kind of very complicated, difficult, but instructive. And I think those kinds of questions about how Black women live through a very sort of complexly rendered set of ideas and practices that are geared toward freedom while it's being constrained at every step. Mm-hmm. I think those are the kinds of considerations that animate what aligns my work with the broader project of Transnational Black Feminisms as a working group.
That's great.
Yeah.
One thing that you just said, I've recently taught your book and read it, so I wanted to push a little bit, because one thing you just said is your book looks at how freedom can be complexly occupied, right? So
yeah.
I wonder, is there a kind of anecdote or vignette in the book that you think surprises people often when you position it along the kind of spectrum of freedom behavior? So you don't go from enslavement to full emancipation, right? You're on equal footing with the British now. Is there like a moment that often will surprise people that you position that as a kind of step toward freedom or example of freedom?
Well, when I've given lectures or taught about the 1858 riot that ends my book, I think that's probably one of the most surprising elements to people who even are familiar in a community relation to the history of Antigua and Barbuda. So the 1858 riot, which is the ending chapter to my book, looks at these moments of, I guess, contestations that first unfold between Antiguans and Barbudans living in the capital town of Antigua, which is St. John's. There are a bunch of dock workers competing for jobs, and it sort of erupts into this several day conflagration in the center of the town between aggrieved Antiguans and the police and then the general colonial authority. And a lot of people didn't know that that even happened. It was not a part of local lore. And I think, unlike many of the post-emancipation uprisings around the Caribbean that sort of have a certain resonance, a certain kind of heroism attached to them, it's very leaderless. There is not a singular charismatic set or a set of like vilified figures. It's a set of rabble in the streets, essentially. And that's how the British describe them. And the fact of the matter is, I especially was paying a lot of attention to how women who participated in the fighting were described by colonial officials and the things that they were said to have said. Because there is this long set of trials after, and multiple people are jailed. It's a big deal for a very small island for some, you know, 300-400 people to end up in a jail that probably can't accommodate more than 50 people at a time. And so for that to have happened was this like big sort of unraveling to me that was just so very, you know, kind of, it was manifesting essentially a lot of the problems of freedom that I had felt like I was tracing over the course of the entire book. Because in some ways there were the violence that I thought that I saw being enacted by Antiguan women on Barbudan women in the streets in the name of Barbudan people being seen as a certain type of foreign intruding presence on the island, not only spoke to this ongoing set of historical tensions between so-called sister island formations in the Caribbean, many of which we can point to in the present and see examples of, and Antigua and Barbuda right now have an ongoing set of conflicts around land use in the wake of the 2017 passage of Hurricane Irma. So there's something interesting in this as a rehearsal for that. But I also see what happens where Antiguan women fighting Barbudan women, that's also a rehearsal of the kinds of violences that they were met with both in slavery as bonded labor that was violently pushed toward their productivity, and the access to their bodies was such that was, you know, to quote something I've heard Jennifer Morgan, who is someone who's always been influential on my thought as a historian of women and gender in Atlantic slavery, she said that, you know, enslaved women had no private life to call their own, that everything they did was for the public marketplace. And so the very public way in which women's bodies would be stripped and, you know, and assaulted, those kinds of acts were true in slavery. They're also true for the private lives that that newly free people were trying to build. So in a chapter preceding that, which is another chapter that tends to be a very difficult chapter to give papers on and that people are often shocked by, I talk a lot about the violence that is traced by church missionaries recording the ins and outs of people's homes as a way to proselytize them. And so the irony that the church is sort of recording this to see who's being holy, who's upholding the sanctity of marriage. And then they kind of overlook the actual violence, except for when that violence sort of is revealed to be the effect of someone stepping out of the monogamous formation of marriage that they're supposed to be upholding. And so people getting thrown out of the church for having children out of wedlock, for having outside partners. The violence that takes place as people are trying to negotiate those things within a marriage, within a household, that's not really the church's problem. The church's problem is trying to keep everybody together in a Christian nuclear household of two parents married together in holy matrimony and their legitimate children.
Whatever that looks like.
So those instances of recorded violence, I talk about, and I talk about that also as part of the story of how freedom is a gendered construct and how Black women's freedom is the precarity of Black women's freedom is in fact a sort of an outgrowth of these kinds of situations where freedom to the British establishment and its handmaidens like Christian churches were about accountability to the state, about showing up in a certain way, having a certain kind of comportment. All of those things sort of tie them into the way that the state wants them to be free. Mm-hmm. That creates violence in the homes. You know, I try not to pathologize it. I try to see it as a facet of a bigger structural unfreedom that the British are building an edifice of with every single policy. So that set of violences too, on top of the violences of slavery, are also rehearsed in this 1858 riot that ends the book. Mm-hmm. Where women who are from Antigua are, you know, taking other Barbudan women out of their homes and stripping them in the street and assaulting them. So there's a certain kind of ritual humiliation that I understand as a certain familiarity with the violence against their own bodies that allows them to do that.
This is reminding me of Deb Thomas' Exceptional Violence, yes. Thinking about the scripts of violence rooted in the coloniality.
Yes, and I actually have to say that I regret not having read her book in time for writing my own, because after having read it, I thought, this is all of a piece. This is so very much tied in with the story. This is how, you know, the kind of question of how the Caribbean is a series of repeating islands. Yeah. And the idea that, you know, a lot per Benitez Rojo, that there are so many changing seams to be traced.
But the project, Natasha, is disrupting this notion of inherent deviance. Like, these women in Antigua are not coming up with these practices out of thin air, that they are rehearsing these scripts that are so rooted in the state, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're rooted in the state, they're rooted in the church, they're rooted in Western conceptions of what is the right way to be in public, but also what is, you know, what are the proper public uses of Black women's bodies? Mm. And so that, to me, was something that was surprising and difficult to encounter as I dealt with all of the other questions that I thought my work was going to answer when I walked into the archives about, you know, the sort of familiar stories about, in, you know, what emancipation is about. You know, where did people find land and occupy space, and how did they, you know, construct labor, you know, kinds of labor practices that were in defiance of what, you know, the existing plantation regime expected out of them.
Yeah.
Those questions I'd come armed with and knew I was going to find answers to. And I did.
Right.
But then there were all of these other social texts that came spilling out.
Yeah.
And I think very unintentionally, because it was often these white, you know, interlocutors that are, you know, that have the wherewithal to record anything because they are the ones equipped with pen, paper, literacy, and state access. Those folks are looking for many other things.
What does the archive say about these women, the rabble? How does it describe them?
Funny enough, a lot of them got described as men in 1858. There were a whole bunch. The first article I wrote from that chapter was an article that I published in Slavery and Abolition in 2010 called "Their Coats Were Tied Up Like Men," because that was the description that one of the police officers gave. So that the petticoats that women wore, long petticoats down to their ankles, were being tied up so that their legs could have, you know, room to move. And so the question of how they were being masculinized in the midst of a rebellion that essentially necessitated them having the ability to move. Right? And so this idea, though, of how very easy it is for colonial authorities to fall into the trope of masculinizing Black women's, presence in post-slavery societies just came, you know, kind of flying off the page.
Yeah.
It was hard to miss. So the archive does what it does. And I had to do what I had to do in the line with many other, you know, Black feminist revisionist historians and sort of ask other questions about what their presence and how it's iterated all means.
Yeah, that's great. I want to circle back to something you kind of hinted at a few minutes ago. You said that there is a kind of sometimes tense relationship between Antiguans and Barbudans that has maybe been reinvigorated around the recent, the 2017 hurricanes and land use. Can you say a little bit more about that?
The funny thing is, so Troubling Freedom talks about the sort of the origins of the Antiguan and Barbudan relationship and how Barbuda always was an afterthought of the Antiguan colonial legislature. So a really kind of prominent example would be the fact that the 1833 Abolition Act from the British government never really iterated Barbuda in it. So the Antiguan colonial legislature had to make a decision as to whether or not that applied to Barbuda. And so they had emergency sessions and decided that yes, indeed it does, right? So those kinds of earlier historical examples are part of a much longer arc of neglect by the British that then, when emancipation, you know, kind of passes over into the later 20th century periods of labor rebellion, you know, federation, and then the, you know, kind of slow march toward a negotiated independence from the British, the Barbudans are always sort of like sitting as an addendum to Antigua that is sometimes remembered and sometimes forgotten. And so when 2017's hurricanes destroyed much of the island's surface, Barbudans were put into a position of having to evacuate the island, you know, transfer all of what they could pick up and go to Antigua. And the problem is that Antigua and Barbuda have always developed on separate tracks. Barbuda has always had customarily a form of communal land use, whereas Antigua has always been a site of private property ownership. And especially in the post-federation period, much of the sort of like 1950s, 60s, 70s, mid-century, 20th century Caribbean, the move went from sort of quick and very incomplete forms of industrialization, which is what your work is on, really, right? And in some ways, to this sorts of these sorts of other, you know, kinds of non-industrial sorts of development forms. In Antigua, the biggest, you know, economic driver has been tourism. And tourism necessitates a private, you know, property marketplace. And it's, you know, it's the selling of beachfront access. It's the, you know, determining of when and who can use what land for what purposes. Whereas Barbuda had minimal tourist development and understood themselves as owning the entire land in common. All of that and the history that it sits on has now come to bear in this, you know, kind of very fraught post-hurricane moment where Barbuda's rebuilding under the sort of auspices of the Antiguan government's development plan is one of incorporating private property principles into Barbuda and trying to push for more expensive tourist developments, bringing in American and European capital to the space in ways that local Barbudan people protest with an eye not just to the sustainability of the present, but the longer cycle of, you know, colonial neglect and suspicion of intrusion from the outside and suspicion of the fragile partnership between Antigua and Barbuda politically.
And those protests, have they been pretty widespread. So I imagine to build a resort, it would help to have the title or the deed to a piece of property. What has the opposition looked like in Barbuda?
There have been some, you know, there have been protests, there have been op-eds, there have been, you know, documentaries, there's been a number of, you know, outside reporters coming in, you know, some of whom I worry about, are they trying to advertise the, you know, and get eyes on the Barbudan story, or are they trying to get their Pulitzer? You know, it's just a whole series of question marks around, like, who knows what of the Barbudan story and how is it getting told? And there's a fight over even the understanding of history, because so many Barbudans understand their land to have been inherited from the Codrington family's departure in 1870 from a 200-year lease that they had for the entire island from the British government. The Codringtons didn't will any land because you can't really will lease land, but the idea that Barbudans were supposed to pay rent on their land after that, which was written in certain colonial codes, that was never practiced. That was under, in any way, regularly undertaken. No one has ever paid anything for any of the land that they've had in Barbuda.
Yeah.
And so their understanding of themselves as owning the land in common and take, you know, people always got land use for, you know, one for domicile, one for grazing, you know, one for agriculture. I forget what the other one is, but it's like you could have up to four parcels of land, and that was a custom that was just always undertaken by the Barbudan people and administered by the Barbudan people. And all of that carried on until the hurricane. And then the hurricane became the way to sort of inspect and review and possibly undo all of these practices. And
it's
that,
so interesting how environmental change can lead to this whole revision of history.
Every bit of it. Yeah.
And the emptying out. I remember there was so much coverage of the empty island, there's nothing here, there's no one
here. The Terra Nullius kind of doctrine that allows for these forms of reworking and, you know, revision, again, of what custom they hope would allow protection and law. And ultimately, the current government believes that their way is legally protected because they understand Barbudan land to be crown land, and crown land therefore became state land after the end of the formal colonial relationship with Britain. So as state land, Barbuda is the Antiguan government's to pursue whatever projects they understand themselves as having a stake in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I have one last question for you. What is your relationship to Antigua and Barbuda? You said your family's from there and that's how you came to the work. How do you understand yourself and your work in relation to that space?
So
easy question,
that's so funny. It's a huge question. I think it starts with the fact that just even, you know, so my family, my mother and father were born in Antigua, and so much of what I do comes out of the fact that, you know, growing up, I always say that, you know, my sister and I went to school in the United States, and we'd come home to our apartment in the Bronx, and we would be entering Antigua. And so the idea that we were raised in, you know, steeped in certain types of traditions, foods and music, and the people who my parents most readily socialized with were Antiguans as well, who would come up to New York in the late 60s, early 70s, and also had children in New York. So those were some of our first playmates. Other people they would socialize with were other West Indians from other islands. So it was a kind of ripple effect if we went from there to a certain kind of, like, you know, regionalism that was happening in the, you know, in the kinds of social networks that we were embedded in the Bronx. And so being West Indian was very much a part of my socialization growing up, as much as I was also, funny enough, like I said, I was in America when I would go outside of my apartment, but I wasn't, my Americanness was Black American, right? So, you know, it was the Bronx in the 80s and 90s, and so I was like, it was hip hop, it was salsa, it was, you know, it was the sort of like ruined de-investment of New York City in, you know, the crack era. It was a lot of different things, and I moved between both maybe seamlessly because I didn't think about it.
Yeah.
Because we were always going back and forth to Antigua every summer. Yeah. The minute school ended, that was our childcare for my mom. It was pack your bag and you're off and see you the week before Labor Day. So, you know, I spent long periods of time over my childhood repeatedly on the island, and there was a small set of people, cousins and, you know, friends that I came of age with down there as well. So I've always had like a kind of ongoing circuitry with Antigua. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to graduate school and I was really interested in questions about Black freedom and the making of an African diaspora, and then my dad died and I had to go down to Antigua and spend all this time down there to kind of deal with his affairs, I realized that all the questions I had about Black people, Black freedom, membership in a sort of transnational understanding of a Black community, all of that in many ways came from my understanding of what was Antigua and its story of freedom. And that's kind of how I come to this work. So I would ultimately say, when you say how I place my work, Troubling Freedom, I literally wrote it for Antigua and Barbuda. And I literally say that the dedication in my book, I can read it for you because it just happens to be here. Oh,
please do.
So the dedication of my book is to the people of Antigua and Barbuda and for my sons. Those are the two sets of people. I do everything in my work for my children. But this was a love letter to Antigua and Barbuda. So that's how I see everything. And even the beginnings of the second project I'm writing, it's still from, it grows from a love letter again. You know, and it starts, it's funny enough, the project starts in Antigua and it sort of veers into parts of the Danish West Indies, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of taken me to this whole, you know, new set of questions around the making of freedom between empires. So 20 years ago, while I was researching this book, I found this set of letters between a woman born in Antigua and living at the time in St. Thomas, mm-hmm. trying to understand whether or not the emancipation that had been passed in 1834 for the British Islands applied to her as an Antiguan-born enslaved woman currently laboring on an estate as a mortgaged slave. Mm. To a Danish plantation owner in St. Thomas.
Mm.
And she was trying to figure out how could she get this thing to apply to her because she had heard that there were announcements about this. Mm. That letter set me on an entire path, and I did not realize there were lots of people like this who were transferred between British Islands and the islands of other empires in the Caribbean. And that multiple people have figured out that British islands after 1834 had become free space and that they could actually claim potentially freedom because they were in some way covered by this subjecthood.
Mm.
But even for this woman, I wrote an article about her story in the William & Mary Quarterly in 2022, and it was all about how she was conferred a freedom that could not extend to her child.
Mm.
So she left one of her children behind, ostensibly. I don't know for sure, but that's what the archive seems to tell me. And that it raised for me how the heritability of slavery, the sort of partus sequitur ventrum principle, doesn't quite extend
to freedom.
Yeah. So slavery is heritable because Black women's wombs were always unfree. But freedom is something that, you know, comes by dint of your birth. And so child is born in, you know, a non-free space of, you know, Danish St. Thomas. And so
There they stay.
So that's where my next book is taking me. And it still sort of begins with the question of how Antiguan people are trying to get free. And I think I'm always going to be asking, how do Antiguan people, how do Barbuda people try to get free? Like, that's just where all the beginnings of anything start for me.
But so, That's the work.
Thank you.
Natasha Lightfoot, this was great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.